You're listening to the Tan Talk Radio Network.
In my mind, I'm born to Carolina. Can't you see the sunshine? Can't you just feel the moonshine? Ain't it just like a friend of mine to hit me from behind? When I'm gone to Carolina in my mind. Karen, she's a silver sun. You best walk her away and watch her shine. Watch her, watch the morning come. A silver tear appearing now, while I cry in need. I'm gone to Carolina in my mind. There ain't no doubt in no one's mind that love's the finest thing around. Whisper something soft and kind. Baby, the sky's on fire. I'm dying, and I'm gone to Carolina in my mind.
Hey, go to Carolina in your car. You know what? If you go in your car, I mean, you can go in your mind, but if you go in your car, it's a better experience. That's what I have found. Good morning. And welcome to Freedom Works, the Paul Molloy Show. I am Paul Molloy. That was James Taylor singing that very, I think, fine rendition. But this is Freedom Works, Tampa Bay's libertarian radio voice. It is Monday, April the 28th. Wow, the month is flying by. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. We're going to be talking in a few minutes with Steve Hanke. Now, Steve is an economist at Johns Hopkins University. And he's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. And we're going to be talking about an article he's written, which is going to come out next month. It's called Measuring Misery Around the World. Now, wouldn't that be a fun job, going around the world measuring misery? Well, we'll talk to him about that and the misery index. Also, the head of a major labor union is really down on Obama. He's telling the president to wake up and allow the approval of the Keystone Pipeline. And in our Freedom Works Ultimate Top 10 list, the 10 longest living animals. And you are going to be absolutely shocked at the length of life of some animals. I'm guaranteeing you, if you don't know anything about this thing, wait till you hear it. Anyway, we're Freedom Works, and we come to you Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time here on the great Tan Talk Radio Network. We are here to talk about the libertarian perspective, the idea that the more freedom that you possess, the happier, the better off, the more fulfilled you'll be. Now, that was something, by the way, that you were promised in the Declaration of Independence. The Constitution was created to set out and allow you that personal freedom. And we believe that that is the kind of liberty, especially in Washington, that has been eroding. So we're glad you're with us. We'd love to have you call in with your thoughts and questions. Our toll-free number, 866-826-1340. Again, it's 866-826-1340. If you want to call it locally, you can do so, 727-441-3000. And you can access our program and find out more about it by taking a look at our website, which is thefreedomworks.com. It includes our podcast set up by my colleague Lee Clark so that it's easy for you to go back and chronologically select a show, and the speaker is listed so you know a little bit about what we're going to talk about. Again, it's our website, thefreedomworks.com. Well, as I mentioned, Steve Hanke is coming on in just a few minutes, and he's written an article that will appear in the May 2014 issue of Globe Asia. And it's called Measuring Misery Around the World. And he says that as the Great Recession grinds on, politicians of all stripes, usually behind closed doors, are asking just how miserable are our citizens. Now, the chattering classes, he says, offer a variety of opinions, and as it turns out, there is a straightforward way to measure misery. Mathematically, the late Arthur Okun, a distinguished economist who served as chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors in the Johnson administration, Lyndon Johnson, has developed the original misery index. His index was equal to the sum of the inflation rate and the unemployment rate. So, for instance, if you had, say, an unemployment rate of 7% and an inflation rate of 2%, your misery index would be 9%. But Steve mentions that the misery index pours cold water on the current critique of free markets and fiscal austerity. He says Harvard professor Robert Barrow amended the misery index by adding the 30-year government bond yield and the output gap for real GDP. Now, Barrow uses his index to measure the change in misery during a president's term. And so Hanke says that from these mathematics or metrics or whatever you want to call them, he says we would anticipate that if there were a high level of misery in a country and the current politicians increased it, in other words, increased the level of misery, then the increase would be borne out by looking at the polls. In other words, will the index of a president's approval rating go up or down? And it would be mirroring the misery index going up or down. And Hanke says the data in the misery index speaks loudly. He says, contrary to the dogma of liberals and left-wing ideologists, the free market years under Ronald Reagan were very good ones as far as the misery index was concerned, and the Clinton years of Victorian fiscal virtues, when Clinton proclaimed the era of big government is over, they were also very good ones for us. The misery index was apparently very low at that time. So I think this will be a very interesting conversation with Steve Hanke in a few minutes. In the meantime, the unions, and especially one of the major labor unions, lambasting President Obama over the delay in the Keystone XL pipeline. Terry O'Sullivan, he's the leader of the Laborers International Union. It represents about 500,000 construction workers. He claims that the administration's announcement on Good Friday that it was going to put off a decision on Keystone, possibly until after the elections in November, has politics written all over it. And he writes a piece in the Washington Post and he says that, quote, the Obama administration grow a set of antlers or take a lesson from Popeye and eat some spinach, unquote. So, as you can see, there are a lot of Democrats, especially labor union Democrats, that are wondering what President Obama is doing. Terry O'Sullivan has turned to various media outlets, including the Wall Street Journal, to voice his frustration with the Keystone thing. And he says the only thing holding back President Obama is courage. Now, the administration, as you may know, announced it is extending its look into the Keystone issue indefinitely. You know, it's been going on for 6 years. So everybody knows it's politics. And it has nothing to do with looking into anything. Every single indicator that they used in the government to check this pipeline has come out positive for the pipeline. So this is one more issue, I think, that is going to hurt President Obama as we move into the elections. But when some major Democrats are upset, you know that President Obama should seriously take a look at it. Anyway, we're going to take a short break. We're going to come back after that. We're going to talk with Steve Hanke and the Misery Index.
Can't you see the sunshine? Hello, my friend. I'm Glenn Pav of the Glenn Pav Show, Righting the Right, heard weekdays at 9 a.m. prime time on the Tantalk Radio Terrestrial Network, on the TuneIn smartphone app, on Audio Now cell phone network 712-432-7102, and on Internet radio at 1 p.m. on the Constitutional Patriot Radio Network on CPRWorldWideMedia.com. Here's a look at this week's lineup. Local politics, no tax for tracks in the light rail debacle. Then on healthcare, the MD Plus health insurance alternative. Then on patriotism, my constitutional study on the making of America. Then on education, my Common Core update of the debacle. And then on politics and religion, my conservative Christian perspective on the news. Well, that about sums it up. For more details, look me up on the web at writingtheright.com, spelled R-I-G-H-T. That's writingtheright.com. And join me this week with my guests and co-hosts. That's the Glenn Pav Show, live weekdays at 9 a.m. primetime, just after Imus in the morning on the Tantalk Radio Network. And folks, let's keep writing the right.
You're listening to the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hey, we're back. Freedom Works. I am Paul Molloy. Thank you very much for joining us. And we're delighted to have Steve Hamke, who was the he's an American applied economist at the John Hopkins University in Baltimore, and is also a senior fellow and director of the Troubled Currencies Project at the Great Cato Institute in Washington. He's penned an article that will appear next month in Globe Asia magazine calling Measuring Misery Around the World. Steve, welcome to Freedom Works.
Good to be with you, Paul.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. We spoke just prior to your coming on a little bit about what you wrote. I find this fascinating. I've heard of the term misery index. I was never sure exactly what it was. But you go on to talk a little bit about it and the fact that certain things have been added to it to come up with the formula. But would you let people know at first, what is the misery index? Why was it originally created?
Well, it was originally created by Professor Arthur Oaken, who at the time was the chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors when he developed this thing for President Johnson. And the original misery index was just inflation plus unemployment. And Oaken's argument, which is valid, is that if you have a misery index and you have, it's just a simple thing, inflation plus unemployment, that would give the president some indicator of just what was happening in the economy and the state of the economy, and give him some insight also into why his poll numbers were either going up or going down. If the misery index goes up, your poll numbers go down. You become more unpopular because people have a higher degree of misery.
So, for instance, I used the right formula earlier when I said, let's say you had an unemployment rate in the U.S. of, say, 7% overall and then a 2% inflation, your misery index is 9%.
Yeah, that's the simple original Oaken misery index. And then it subsequently got revised and altered. Professor Barrow at Harvard did work on this and added some things to it, and then subsequently I've added and adjusted some things to the thing, and now you can get international statistics rather easily for 90 countries, so now I've got a world table for misery index calculations for 90 countries, and that one is the following. You still have unemployment and inflation, and then you add to that a third thing, and that's the interest rate or lending rate that banks charge to take out a loan. And then you subtract from that the rate of growth in the economy, because if the economy is growing, that's a good thing. So you subtract a little from the misery index with that.
So I'm starting to think I'm going to need a calculator here to figure the misery index.
Yeah, well, it's fairly easy. Just think, add three things together, inflation, unemployment, and the interest rate charged on loans with banks.
Okay.
And then subtract from that sum of those three elements one thing, and that's the growth rate in the economy.
So, Steve, we can go to any country and we can then measure their particular misery index, correct?
Right. Okay. You can do it. And I just simply took the economic intelligence units numbers for those items, those four items that go in the formula, so we don't have to get a complicated compilation. We just use one source, the Economic Intelligence Unit. Whatever they're reporting, you just plug it into the formula, and you come up with the misery index. So we end up with the, as of the end of last year, Venezuela was the most miserable place on earth, and then you had Iran, and then you had Serbia, and then you had Argentina, and then you had Jamaica, then you had Egypt. Then we get into some bigger countries. Spain was number 7, South Africa, Brazil, and Greece was number 10. And on the good side, you've got Japan is the least miserable.
Really?
And you've got some usual suspects in there that you would expect, South Korea, Taiwan,
right.
Singapore, Thailand.
I would think they're particularly miserable in North Korea, if that's at all measurable.
Well, we don't have the data.
We don't have the data from them. They turn off the lights at night.
Yeah, they turn off the lights at night.
So you
the inflation's what we can gather, the inflation's very high. I've been making some estimates about inflation in North Korea. It's high, but the numbers are a little shaky. And they're not in this economic intelligence unit thing. So,
yes.
We don't really have comparable data that go in with these 90 other countries.
Right.
You know, 90 is pretty good. That's about half the country.
Oh yeah, terrific. We're talking with Steve Hanke. He is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. He's also an American applied economist at Johns Hopkins University. We're talking about the misery index. He's penned an article on that. And, Steve, so where does the United States fit in the misery index worldwide?
Well, the United States is 71st out of 90. In other words, 90 is the best, and there's 71. So not too bad.
Has that been going? Has our number been getting closer? Over the years, which way is it going?
Well, it's fairly elevated right now, but that's because of the crisis, the financial crisis. We're still in the Great Recession, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that, the biggest contributor to the misery index in the United States is unemployment. And by the way, then if you go beyond this, if the things that people don't like, if we have inflation, and of course they don't like inflation, and we have the bank, the interest rates banks charge you, and the people don't like higher rates, obviously, and economic growth, they like that, but the one thing that they really don't like is unemployment. If you don't have a job, you don't like it.
I mean, that's the top of the misery index.
So that is the biggest contributor to the misery index score that you get in the United States. And so it's not surprising that the president right now, President Obama, has very low poll ratings, very weak poll ratings, because the misery index as I say, it's worse than it was 10 years ago, or certainly it was worse than it was in the Reagan era or the Clinton era.
We were happier, in other words, back then, overall, with the way things were going.
The 1990s were pretty good. And Reagan, by the way, out of all the post-war presidents, has the best score in terms of reducing the misery index of any of the presidents, and then the one that's right close to him is Clinton.
Yeah.
So everyone is pretty happy with Reagan and Clinton, and the rest of the presidents are a fairly motley bunch, with Obama coming in with actually very low scores in that regard. I mean, I can give you these because I did the calculations. You have Reagan as the best, then Clinton, and then Kennedy Johnson, and then you've got George W. Bush, and he's on the negative side. See the only ones. Let's put it this way. Let's keep it simple. The only ones who improved the misery index during their presidencies and were on the good side of history in that regard were Reagan, Clinton, and the Kennedy Johnson administration.
So things were worse when
everyone else it made things worse.
Okay, but
with Carter being the worst, Nixon and Ford a disaster, the second term of Eisenhower pretty bad. And Obama, pretty bad.
Okay. So they actually, Reagan and Kennedy Johnson, turned things around and,
yeah, and
actually...
Clinton, don't forget Clinton.
And Clinton, I'm sorry.
Clinton,
those three.
Clinton did too. Clinton,
yeah.
Big time.
Exactly. So those three actually turned it around.
This is just an objective measure. And the thing that with these four elements, and then I looked at the changes in these... with regard to these various administrations, and Reagan just comes out on top, period.
Right.
And then Clinton is in there pretty good, and Kennedy Johnson was in there pretty good, and of course, those presidencies, this is related to politics and popularity, because looking back now, who becomes a very popular president? Well, of course, Kennedy's very, very popular. Reagan's very popular, and Clinton's very popular.
Right. In fact, Clinton was able to survive that sex scandal, and maybe it was because his misery index was so low, right?
Oh, there's no question about it.
Yeah. Okay.
You have to now, with regard to Clinton, and especially for your listeners, most people don't realize, but Clinton cut the size of government relative to the total economy way more than any president since World War II. There's no one even close to Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
Clinton chopped government expenditures as a percent of GDP by 3 percentage points. No one is even close. Reagan did slightly, it was way less than 1%. But everyone else actually has been on the increase.
Yes, and you fact alluded to the fact that when Clinton proclaimed in January 96 that the era of big government is over, he actually was being somewhat correct about that.
Well, as far as he was concerned, he was very correct.
Yeah,
and remember. In terms of fiscal austerity, which liberals like to yell and scream about now, Clinton was the biggest squeezer that we ever had, because in the last 2 years of his second term, he actually ran fiscal surpluses. Now we can hardly even remember such a thing occurred.
Right. That's so true.
And at the time, all the Wall Street crowd were panicked because they said, "Oh, there aren't going to be any more government bonds anymore because they'll be paying off all the debt."
Well, he had Newt Gingrich and also a Republican-controlled Congress that was kind of steering him, though, in that direction. Right? It was.
Well,
we have to give them some credit.
The divided government during that period with Clinton was optimal. That's what you want. You want the Congress and the White House to be of different parties so that it stalls everything up and gums everything up.
Well, how come it's not working so well now? We got a Republican Congress and a Democratic president, and the
public stupidly complains that they're not getting anything done in Washington.
And they should be happy with this.
There's a big difference between Clinton and Obama.
Right.
And that is number one, the Congress isn't totally divided anyway. The Senate's a Democratic Senate now.
That's right.
And that wasn't the case with Clinton.
That's true.
The Republicans controlled the Congress, both the Senate.
Both House and Senate.
And that was an optimal thing. And you had a smart president. Clinton was smart politically, and he adjusted. and got with the flow of the thing. So you mentioned Gingrich. Yeah, Gingrich was up on Capitol Hill. Fine. But the guy who really was smart was Clinton.
Well, that's an excellent point. We're talking again with Steve Hanke. He has written a very interesting article. It's going to appear next month, and it's called Measuring Misery Around the World. It will be in the Globe Asia magazine, the May 2014 issue.
Paul, I can't get that now. It actually is posted on the Cato Institute website.
Right.
If you go to the Cato Institute website and plug in my name, and then you find the article.
I should have mentioned
it's called Measuring Misery Around the World.
Exactly. I read it. And it's, as I said, very interesting. We're talking a little bit about the Misery Index. And so we look at President Obama. He has, like you said, a Democratic Senate and a Republican Congress. It's not the same thing as it was with President Clinton. But we look now, and I want to go back to the poll numbers and the favorable ratings, et cetera. So do the favorable ratings of President Obama in these polls accurately reflect the misery index numbers that you come up with?
Yeah, there's no question about it. There's a very high correlation between it's an inverse correlation between the misery index and the poll ratings. In other words, if you have a high score on the misery index is high, you're going to have a low poll ratings, and it works like a charm. I mean, it's just common sense.
Yes. No, I think you're right. You're absolutely right.
It doesn't take a genius to figure this kind of
stuff. Well, it takes
out
somebody smart like you, though, to come up with the formula. And
that's true. You just got to add the number. You get a big spreadsheet and put the
and work it
together.
Out.
But the bottom line is, Most of these things, you have to realize in economics, if something isn't intuitive and doesn't make sense, it's probably hokum.
So now we got an election coming up in November, and everybody is talking about, and I guess this correlates to the misery index, and where things are pretty rough right now. Everybody is talking about the fact that the Republicans will probably have an excellent chance of taking control of the Senate, raising their numbers in the House. Now, if that occurs, and there are two more years at this point left in the Obama administration, will we start to have the kinds of positive results that we had with with Clinton, do you think?
Depends on what their policies are. I don't think any of the ideas floating around are all that exciting in terms of economic policy. I mean, I see no manifesto by either party that it gives me much of a positive shock, shall we say?
Yes, another.
You got to have. You got to have something big like Reaganomics. I mean, Reaganomics was big. It turned the whole thing around. That's why he was number one. And Clinton quickly figured out he was going to go with that flow, and that approach to sound fiscal management and continue on the track of, good reforms and so forth. He wasn't going to turn back the clock on Reagan, basically.
Right.
And so he lived off that momentum and did a great job of it. So the 90s were very good.
They were indeed.
Basically, you had the 80s, Reagan turned the whole thing around with a set of good big policies in general. And that's why his misery index scores were good. He had good poll ratings. He looked on favorably even now. And Clinton, as I say, was smart enough not to turn back the clock, not to fight it, to go with the flow, go with the momentum. And the 90s, as a result, were terrific.
Very, very, very interesting, Steve. We've been talking with Steve Hanke. Again, he's an American applied economist at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore and a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Steve, thank you so much. I know the people should get to the Cato Institute website and look for the article Measuring Misery Around the World. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Paul.
All right. Yes, sir. Steve Hanke. All right, my friends, take a short break. Remember, we're going to tell you the longest living animals in a few minutes. Stay tuned.
There is a young cowboy who lives on the range. His horse and his cattle are his only companions. He works in the saddle and he sleeps in the canyons, waiting for summer, his pastures to change.
Imus in the morning.
Let's go back in the green room now and talk to Larry Flint. Good morning, Larry.
I have some submissions for It Might Be Elvis.
Okay. Well, no, I picked the songs It Might Be Elvis.
Yeah, well, I'm picking them now. Now what?
All right.
Walkie. How about Fats Domino? Not walking. No, indeed. Not running. Can't use my feet. I'm hoping you'll come back to push me. How about some ZZ Top? She got legs, and she knows how to use them. She just brags, because I had to lose them. Yeah. Aerosmith, and she told me to walk this way, because she was a bitch. Lou Reed, hey, babe, take a walk on the wild side. I can't, babe. I guess I'll just take a ride, Clyde. Johnny Cash, I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I know just how to make a dollar sign. And though once both of my legs were just fine, now I'm inclined to roll the line. How about the Bengals? Lay around like an Egyptian, mummy. Nancy Sinatra, these boots were made for walking, but that's not what they'll do. One of these days, these boots, I'm going to rub all over you. Dionne Warwick, if you see me rolling down the street, I'll try real hard not to run over your feet. Shalomba.
Catch Imus in the Morning right here on the stations of the Tantalk Network.
Sing of their home in the sky. Maybe you can believe it if it helps you to sleep. But singing works just fine for me.
Hey, we're back on Freedom Works. I hope you enjoyed that laugh break that we took. You can thank Lee Clark for that. He puts these things together from the Imus in the Morning Show. Lee, shame on you.
It's my fault. It's no reflection upon Paul.
Nobody laughs.
Paul actually,
Nobody laughs harder, though.
Yeah, well, I know. You know, your image is a very, compassionate, a fair, honest individual, but we do have a good laugh.
Oh, my goodness.
On those,
yeah, when the mic goes off, things change.
Yeah. We've got the one I was going to play on Friday, and it was funny because remember it was You're So Vain, and we were talking about Mick Jagger.
Yes.
Well, Rob Bartlett did an impersonation of Mick Jagger singing Sympathy for the Eye Man or something. I forget who it was, but it's 3 minutes long. I don't know if you wanted to do it.
We'll have to do it one of these days. It's that good, huh?
It's okay.
It's okay.
It's not great.
Wow.
It's 3 minutes long. I thought you might be at about 1.5 minutes, you might be looking at me like...
1.5 minutes of okay?
Cut this thing.
Uh-huh. Anyway. Well, I mean, if it was great, then I would say devote 3 minutes to it. But if it's okay, it'd be 3 minutes?
Friday would have been the opportunity.
Friday. Well, I'll tell you what, we'll look
Mick
at...
Jagger.
Yeah.
We were talking about him, the You're So Vain thing. Which
Friday would have been very appropriate because we were talking about it.
So we
had Carly Simon as our singer on that day. And indeed, she sang the song. And Lee, you mentioned that Mick Jagger was actually in the studio when she sang it, right?
He did the backup vocals on the song. It's uncredited, but you can hear him if you listen. And apparently she has divulged her secret to who the song is about to a number of people, and it seems to be really a composite, so it's not about one specific person. But it's Warren Beatty, Mick Jagger, and there's some other.
Yeah.
She had a lot of boyfriends,
Oh, I bet.
A lot of boyfriends.
I believe that. I believe that. And big-time famous boyfriends.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Look at Madonna. Same way, right?
Similar.
Similar kind of thing.
Yeah, Carly Simon had a little bit more class,
Well, Carly Simon, I liked her voice.
She has a beautiful voice.
I think she's got a soulful, beautiful voice. Anyway,
amazing.
We have another media story of interest. Everyone's talking about it. I'm going to take a little bit of a different perspective, and that is this guy, Donald Sterling. He owns the Los Angeles Clippers NBA basketball team, and he has been caught not knowing he was on microphone, saying some very negative racial things about black people, and it's come out. He owns a basketball team. 80% of the players on the team are African American. It's not a very good idea to say things negatively about people that you employ. Anyway, we all know that. And but here's something you may not know. Donald Sterling is a Democrat, a contributing Democrat, even though he owns a, you know, you would think, white guy, rich, got to be a conservative Republican. Not necessarily. He's a Democrat. And again, he was saying some things to a girlfriend of his. She is a biracial girlfriend, by the way. And her name is Stiviano. Have you heard of this story, by the way, Lee, and this this girlfriend and what she...
Oh, yeah, they were talking about it this morning. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I'm sure everybody is. And I probably know less about it than a lot of people at this point. But apparently she and Sterling had it out or got into an argument. And she decided to release these conversations, I'm sure, much to his consternation. Now, what he said was stupid. Stupid, you know. He basically said, I don't want you associating. Why do you have to associate with black people? How stupid can you be? You know, tell her who to associate with and then pick out a particular race. He could have said it about Chinese or white people and it would have been just as stupid. So having said that, here's my comment. He has every right to say it. He has every right to say whatever he wants to say that way because he has a freedom of speech like we all do. And if our most intimate conversations, anybody's, were publicized to everybody else, we'd all be in hot water because we say stupid things. This is particularly stupid. It's particularly offensive. But again, he has every right to say whatever he wants to say. And in certain cases, when he says something, it's a private matter between he and whoever he is saying it to, like in this particular situation. Now, if I was on that team and I was a black player, you're darn right I would be upset. You're darn right. How could you not be? And they are. And it may lead to his being kicked out as the owner of this team. Now, this isn't the first time he's gotten in trouble for saying certain things or doing certain things. But anyway, I just want to give the one perspective. It's the same thing with our friend in Nevada. That Clive Owens or whatever his name is. I can't even think of his name now.
Bundy?
Yeah.
Clive and Bundy.
Thank you.
You know, I read that
He can say those things. They sound stupid. But in the context of what he was saying, remember he was saying that he remembered growing up, he would go into these certain black neighborhoods, and he would see all these people sitting on the stoops of their entryways. You know, I tell you what, I remember when I lived in Memphis as a little boy seeing that. And I didn't think anything of it. They were relaxing, et cetera. But he brought it into a context of unemployment. And then the fact that the welfare... mentality had, you know, grouped people together, all the black people together, and put them in certain neighborhoods, and they just sat there, and, you know, the welfare thing didn't allow them the freedom to want to go out and make the effort, et cetera. So all of that was tying in. I'm sorry, Lee, what were you?
Nothing important.
Oh, yeah.
I can't believe I had my mic on here. Oh, I was going to say that apparently Clive and Bundy's comments were sort of taken out of context. And
they,
you know,
were.
I sit here and do audio engineering. You know, Paul, we can whatever we want them to say. You know, we could totally twist the meaning of what somebody was trying to say just by messing with
it.
And they
is
do it
done
the big
all
networks
the time.
Do it.
It's done. I was just going to say, it's done all the time. MSNBC and NBC got into trouble by technically lifting out certain words. Remember with the Trayvon Martin incident and the phone call to the police?
Right. They edited that
to make it sound like he sounded more racist in the edited version.
Absolutely, and that
so that's exactly
not, that's
right. It isn't, and it's the same thing. You're exactly right with Bundy. Bundy was making a general comment about the ability of a certain group of people to perform better. And, you know, here's the problem, though. When you group people, I don't care how you group them, you're going to get in trouble. Don't group people. If you, the whole concept of our show is individual liberty. That's where you don't group people. Because once you do, once you say, here's a group of people, whether it's the men or the women or the blacks or the whites or the Catholics or the Jews or, the, you know, whatever you do by grouping, it means that it's one group as opposed to another group. And that's where you always have a clash of ideals. And it happens every time. So did these two guys say some stupid things? They certainly seem to, especially Sterling, with the ownership of the Los Angeles Clippers. But they have a right to say things. And sometimes if you listen to the entire thing, you will formulate a little bit of a different opinion. Anyway, so much for that. The National Rifle Association is going after former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg in a certain way. They have used a recent announcement by Bloomberg, who has vowed to spend $50 million to push gun control measures. They're using that to remind members of the NRA of their Second Amendment rights, and that they are in jeopardy with people like Bloomberg. Now, Chris Cox, who is the NRA executive director, on Friday spoke to a group in Indianapolis, and he said that Bloomberg wants to take away our guns. Cox said he thinks, meaning Bloomberg, he thinks he can buy the hearts and minds of America. I believe that God gave us this freedom, and he's not going to let Michael Bloomberg take it away. Not now, not ever. So, now Cox oversees the lobbying campaign, and of course, when they see a comment like that and an action like that from somebody like Michael Bloomberg, to them, their eyes light up and dollar signs appear in them. And that's what Cox will make sure that that message of Bloomberg's will get out, because it will indeed increase the donations to the National Rifle Association. When I worked at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce back in the 80s and early 90s, I remember how happy we were when we would get either a Ted Kennedy or a Jesse Jackson or somebody that was usually perceived as very liberal to say something on the somewhat outrageous side. We would make sure that we printed the thing up and made sure that our members heard about it, and we got more money. That's how you do it. If you don't have somebody that you can put up there and point at as the enemy, you're not going to get that much money if everything's going well. So I'm sure that the people at the NRA are delighted that that happened. Let's do this. I've got a couple more things I want to talk about before we get to the old. Oh, wait till you hear about the oldest living animals, the top 10. You're not going to believe how long some animals live. Lee, wait till you hear this. You're going to be surprised. Anyway, let's take a break. We'll come back, do a couple more stories, and then we'll do it.
Imus in the Morning.
Please welcome to the Imus Morning program, Mick Jagger. What are you going to sing, Mick?
Sympathy for the Army. All
right, Mick.
All right.
Woo! Oh, wow.
Oh my God. Allow me to introduce someone, a man of great wealth with poor taste. He's been around for 40 years, about 15 of them a total waste. Don't remember much of the 70s due to alcohol and cocaine. Though he's since cleaned up his act, I don't feel well, he always complained. We believe you know his evil name. in Palmdale, California, when he first made himself a name. Ordering 1,200 hamburgers, which today he thinks was painfully lame. Only guarantees you'll be ill at ease when you hear him wheeze, cause he just can't breathe. We believe you know his evil name. Oh yeah. But what's puzzling you is how the hell did he gain fame?
I might be enough here.
Says most every guest is a loser. Looks on his staff with pain, disdain. Behind his back they call. We believe you know his evil name. Oh, yeah. But what's puzzling you? How the hell did he get there? Oh, yeah. Get down, baby.
I'm sorry you couldn't say it on the radio.
All right. Oh, yeah.
Catch Imus in the Morning right here on the stations of the Tantalk Network.
We should have had Mick Jagger as our Billboard music.
I was going to say, can we do the Stones today?
We should have done the Stones. That was funny.
Thanks for sitting through that.
No, that was funny. He was, again, is that Rob Bartlett?
Rob Bartlett. And he was probably dancing to it.
I bet he was. And he probably was wearing some sort of outfit too, right?
Jagger-esque outfit.
Yeah. Oh, that's funny. My goodness. I don't know how he can get back.
Had him laughing in the studio.
Oh, my goodness. Everybody was laughing. That was funny. Hey, the Obama administration is making plans to set up a library. You know, all the presidents, ex-presidents get a library, right? We've got Bill Clinton's library in Arkansas, and we've got George Bush's library in Texas. And okay, so where are they going to put the Obama library? There are two places they're considering. First is Hawaii, where Obama was born, and that makes sense. The second place is Chicago, where Obama came to fame as a community organizer, and then he went on to the Senate from Illinois in Chicago. Well, so they decided to take a look at the possibility of putting the library at the University of Chicago, which is on the city's near south side. Well, Illinois Democrats are now backing off a plan to give $100 million of state money towards this library. The reason is Illinois is broke. It can't afford to give $100 million to the Obama State Library, Obama Library. And as there always seems to be in Chicago politics, accusations of voting shenanigans have popped up in how they came about deciding to send $100 million to the Obama Library. A Democrat-led House committee actually approved the money last week in Chicago at an out-of-town hearing. They weren't even in the city when they did it. And they made sure no Republicans were in attendance. It was all Democrats at the get-together. Then they relied on a procedural move that allowed them to use votes from a previous meeting that included Republicans. In other words, take the votes from a certain thing that happened a long time ago, take just that those votes and bring them forward and use them now for a new issue. That's how you get things done in Chicago. They probably had a few people that were dead that voted on the earlier issues and are voting on these now. So here's State House Republican leader Jim Durkin in Illinois. What they did last week was underhanded and sneaky and offers further proof they no longer can be trusted with taxpayer money. And here's a state Republican leader, Dwight Kaye. He said his previous vote was used about on this library, he said, should not count. He said, even if you could bring it forward on this issue, I'm only a temporary member of the committee, and my vote shouldn't have any counting in this particular rule. He said, this is typical Chicago politics. The Chicago Democrats that knew I would not support spending $100 million that we don't have for a presidential library, so they decided to violate their own rules and cast my vote anyway. So there you go. Well, needless to say, it hit the fan, and now they're all backing off this whole thing. Because the state of Illinois is $7 billion in debt. They owe that to their vendors. And they have a $100 billion, that's with a B, $100 billion shortfall in their employee pension programs. So I don't know where they think they're going to come up with $100 million other than to steal it from something else somewhere.
How about Kenya, Paul? I think that'd be a good
That's one other place they could put it. I don't think there'd be as many visitors there, but yeah, that's a possibility.
Maybe the construction costs would be cheaper.
Yeah. Now, Hawaii really is bidding for it. And I think that's as good a place, but how about, you know, the Clinton Library and the Bush Library were created with private funds. They did not use, that was the point. They don't use taxpayer funds. So get private funds. Build them anywhere you want. Build a library any way you want. Here's a final story I wanted to bring in before we get to our top 10. The liberal watchdog group Media Matters, it's called Media Matters for America. They're basically liberals, and they look at media. They go after Fox News and conservative talk radio and things like that. Media Matters is actively fighting a bid to be unionized. Its staff has been approached by unions, and now Media Matters, which tends to be pro-union, doesn't want it inside their headquarters. Previously, the union and Media Matters had publicly downplayed the argument that they were having, saying they hope to resolve it. That apparently came to an abrupt end late last week, and Local 500 of the Service Employees International Union now says talks have stalled, and Media Matters is lawyering up. So there you go. Pro-union when it has nothing to do with me. When it has something to do with me and my pocketbook, hey, that's a different story. Anyway, it is time, finally, for the top 10 longest living animals.
The talk show hosts are not included on this list, right?
No. Okay. However, there have been some that might have made a good attempt at getting on the top 10. They might have been 12th or 13th. Talk show hosts tend to live way too long. Now, you're not going to believe this, so we'll start with number 10 once we get ready.
Sure.
I love this. Like the coronet anyway, but anyway.
Got to give Ringo a cortisone shot or something.
Ringo is going to be our drummer on this. And here we go. This is, in the longest living animals category, number 10. The warty Oreo. Don't ask me.
What?
Don't ask me. W-A-R-T-Y.
I've eaten one of those before.
Oh, and you wouldn't know it if you did, by the way. The warty Oreo. It's an animal. Now, you got to remember that animals include a lot of crustaceans, amphibians, a lot of animals we don't think about.
Yeah.
But guess how long they live? 140 years. 140. And that's only number 10. Number 9. This is funny. Orange Ruffy.
Orange
Ruffy is an animal.
I think I ate one of those, and I think mine
you
was
You have
about
eaten Orange Ruffy. I have, too.
Mine was 140 years old, if I remember.
Not only that.
It tasted 140 years old.
It's actually, they live to be 149.
Oh, dear.
149. Now, so how does anybody know that? How does anybody
the nuclear
know
submarine?
That? How does anybody know that?
You have to count the rings.
Oh, is that it? Okay.
No.
Here we go. Number 8. The Aldabra giant tortoise is number 8. He lives to be 152 years old. Number 7, Lake Sturgeon. Lake Sturgeon, 152 years. That's a long time to be swimming. That's what I say. Number 6, Short Raker rockfish. Again, we're under the water. Short Raker rockfish, 157. Number 5, back to the turtle family. The Galapagos tortoise, 177 years old. Number 4, under the water for the Red Sea urchin. They make it to 200.
Whoa.
200. In other words, they were around during our revolutionary battles almost. Number three. Under the water again, the rough-eye rockfish. Water must preserve you because the rough-eye rockfish lasts for 205 years.
Maybe they're not. They have less exposure to the sun.
That's exactly
or
it.
Or like all those bad
all
particles that are that were being bombarded with all
exactly.
the time.
Exactly. All of no. the all of the toxic chemicals, they stay under the water. They don't get them. Number two. The bowhead whale. You ever met a bowhead whale
oh,
in
yeah,
the aquarium?
Times.
I bet
sure.
you have. They live to be 211 years of age. That is amazing.
The one I was talking to the other day was 190.
Oh, is that the one that was spouting off?
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember that conversation.
We need just a drum roll for that.
Do we?
Yeah.
What, for spouting off?
No, for your joke. I think it deserved it.
Well, thank you, but it was...
What do you call it?
Yeah, ta-dum.
Cha-ching.
A cha-ching. And finally, the longest living animal in the world. Number one.
It's another tortoise, right?
No. No, it's not.
Another fish?
It's the ocean quahog. Q-U-A-H-O-G.
I've dated one of those.
Wait till you hear how old they live to be. 400.
Yeah, mine was about
400.
That's nuts, Paul.
That means they were around in the 1600s.
They could some stories they could tell.
Oh, could they ever? Shakespeare and the like. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. Freedom Works. We'll be back with you on Monday. Bye for now.
WTAN Clearwater, Tampa Bay. WDCF Dade City, Tampa Bay. WZHR Zephyr Hills, Tampa Bay. Listen.